Hello, everyone. This is Bob Zeta, my amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. We'll be reading together today CQ Magazine in digest format for the month of May 2011. CQ is a publication of CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Amp System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address, all lowercase, handyham@courage.org. Our website is www.handyham.org. Let's begin in ham radio news. Hams a lifeline after quake, tsunami in Japan. Japanese amateurs were providing a lifeline for rescue teams and those at local shelters in the wake of the disastrous 9.0 earthquake and 30-foot tsunami that struck northeastern Japan on March 11. According to International Amateur Radio Union Region 3 Secretary Ken Yamamoto, call JA1CJP, most ham operators were on UHF as well as 7.030 MHz single sideband. Meanwhile, ham radio disaster relief operations in New Zealand were reported to be winding down as commercial services came back online in and around Christchurch, New Zealand, which was hit by an earthquake on February 22. We'll have more details about these commentaries later in the broadcast. Hamvention Award winners announced. The Dayton Amateur Radio Association has named the winners of its prestigious Hamvention Awards for 2011. Shirley Roberts, N8LX of Dayton, was named Amateur of the Year. Roy Llewellyn, amateur call W7EL, will receive the Technical Excellence Award for his development of Easy and Easy Antenna Modeling Software. The Special Achievement Award goes to Fred Lloyd, Alpha Alpha 7 Bravo Quebec, KA7BQ, founder of QRZ.com. The Albemarle Amateur Radio Club of Charleston, Virginia, was named Club of the Year. The awards will be formally presented at the Dayton Hamvention in May. Russia joins CEPT. Many hams from the United States and Europe visiting Russia should find it easier to operate there, as the Russian Federation has decided to join the CEPT, that's the Council of European Post and Telecommunications Administrations, agreement on amateur radio licensing. No effective date has been announced. According to a posting on the Southgate Amateur Radio Club's news page, officials of IARU Region 1 consider the decision a major step forward to achieve worldwide radio amateur roaming. American hams holding extra or advanced class licenses may operate in CEPT countries without special permission. General class licensees have restricted privileges, novices and technicians have none. In other DX news, Southgate also reports that the new government of South Sudan has issued its first amateur license for a DX expedition scheduled for July. No call sign has yet been issued, as the International Telecommunications Union has yet to assign a prefix for Southern Sudan. Also, the Daily DX reports that the planned DX0DX expedition to the Spratly Islands has been postponed again, this time until next April. Team leader VK3FY said the delay was due to circumstances beyond their control and was in the best interests of the team of operators. Alleged pirates indicted in deaths of hams. 13 alleged pirates from Somalia and one from Yemen have been indicted by a federal grand jury in Virginia on piracy, kidnapping, and firearms charges. They were captured at sea by the United States Navy after allegedly taking over a sailing vessel on the coast of Africa and killing the four crew members on board, three of whom were hams. According to Newsline, the four had been delivering Bibles around the world. The suspected pirates will stand trial in Norfolk, Virginia. FCC changes amateur spread spectrum rules. According to a petition filed several years ago by the American Radio Relay League, in March, the FCC issued new rules for using spread spectrum in the amateur bands. According to Newsline, the report and order eliminates the requirement for automatic power control to keep transmitted power to the minimum necessary to maintain a communications link. At the same time, however, the order reduced the maximum power output allowed for an amateur spread spectrum transmitter from 100 watts to 10 watts peak envelope power, PEP. ARIS achieves new milestone. AMSAT reports that a ham radio contact between astronaut Katie Coleman, KC5ZTH, aboard the International Space Station, and students from several schools in Poland marked the 600th school contact for the amateur radio in the International Space Station program. The contact took place on March 17. In other space and satellite news, AMSAT also reports that the Arisat-1 satellite, now on board the ISS awaiting a July launch, was scheduled to be turned on from inside the station on April 12th as part of the celebration of the 50th anniversary of the first manned space flight by Russian cosmonaut Yuri Gagarin in 1961. Two new ham satellites, Fast Track 1 and Fast Track 2, successfully separated from one another on March 15th. They had been launched as a single nano satellite last November, according to the ARRL, and hams were invited to help track them. Fast Track is a project of the University of Texas. As of press time, there is bad news for three other ham satellites, Explorer 1, KSAT-1 and Hermes, all were lost in a launch failure. According to Southgate News, the three satellites were on board the Orbital Sciences Taurus XL rocket, which failed to reach orbit after a March 4 launch. Senegal Telecom Institute gets ham station. A ham station operating on HF and VHF has been set up at an international telecommunications institute in Dakar, Senegal, and a training module on amateur radio has been added to the program offered there. According to Southgate News, the station, sponsored by IARU Region 1's Support to the Amateur Radio Service, or STARS, STARS program, opened recently at École Supérieure Multinationale de Télécommunication, or EMST, which has been designated as the first ITU Center of Excellence. The facility is used to train future telecom engineers and regulators from 14 African countries. Bell Labs develops tiny cellular antenna. A team of researchers at Alcatel-Lucent's Bell Labs has designed and built a cell site in a 2-inch cube, a development that could revolutionize the way cell phone calls and data are routed. According to a Bell Labs news release and news reports, the light radio, that's a trademark cube, consists of three stacked circuit boards, one each for the antenna, the radio, and the network connection, and it would not have to sit on top of a tall tower. It is estimated that wide-scale deployment of these devices could increase network capabilities by up to 30% and reduce or eliminate the need for controversial cell towers. Connections to ham radio? The possibility exists for adaptation to the amateur repeater network and the potential for changes in some restrictive antenna ordinances, many of which were enacted in response to the building of cell site towers. And I have one more news piece for us today. QRM from Plasma TVs. Hams in Ontario, Canada are reporting that they are getting considerable high-frequency interference from plasma screen televisions and have asked the Radio Amateurs of Canada, RAC, for help. Southgate News reports that RAC has asked its members who own plasma TVs to gather data and report on their own interference problems as well as possible solutions. Specific makes and model numbers are requested along with descriptions of the HF ham station antenna and exact nature of the interference. RAC would also like to hear from hams who have plasma TVs but do not experience interference problems. Reports should go to a name, Norm Rashlig, R-A-S-H-L-E-I-G-H, Norm Rashlig, Victor Echo 3, Lima Charlie, VE3LC, RAC, Vice President Slant Industrial Liaison, at the following email address, a call sign, all lowercase, VE3LC at rac.ca. Let's move along now to Zero Bias, a CQ editorial by editor Richard Mawson, called W2VU. This piece is titled Japan and Ham Radio Emergency Communications. While sitting in the airport on March 11, waiting for a flight to Charlotte, North Carolina, my BlackBerry started buzzing with news of a major earthquake in Japan. By the time I landed, we were hearing about the tsunami as well. Of course, at that early stage, no one here had any idea of how massive this natural disaster had been, or that it would be followed by a man-made catastrophe, as workers at the Fukushima nuclear power plant tried frantically to prevent a full meltdown. As I write this a week later, the nuclear disaster is still unfolding, and the scope of damage to both the immediately impacted areas and Japan's economy is becoming manifest. Even offices and factories far from the quake zone have been essentially shut down due to suspension of service on Japan's high-speed rail lines, the country's communication lifeline, and rolling power blackouts throughout the country. Ham radio manufacturers were affected to varying degrees based on the proximity of their factories to the quake zone. What I wasn't hearing in those early hours, though, were reports of ham radio activity and requests to keep frequencies clear for HF emergency traffic. While Japan is the source of most of our ham radio equipment today, it seems that that country has a different model than we do for amateur radio emergency communications and a different perception of what ham should do in a disaster. Unlike in the United States and many other places, hams in Japan do not serve as communication first responders, setting up temporary stations capable of operating without commercial power and keeping information flowing while primary public safety and cellular systems get back up to speed. According to CQ advertising manager Chip Margella, K7JA, who is very familiar with amateur radio in Japan, one main reason for this is because Japan's commercial and public safety communications infrastructure is very robust and less prone to overload or failure in an emergency than similar systems elsewhere. So the need for ham radio support in the early hours of the disaster is greatly reduced. Of course, no one was anticipating a 30-foot tsunami. It was only after several days, as power began to be restored to affected areas, that hams began setting up stations at shelters and emergency operating centers, and that the Japanese Amateur Radio League's headquarters station, JA1RL, began serving as a focal point and clearinghouse for reports from around the country. Ham radio's role of providing backup and supplemental communications is intact in Japan, just not its first responder role. This could be where amateur radio emergency communications in the United States eventually ends up if the planned nationwide interoperable public safety radio service, now being promoted by the Federal Communications Commission and Congress, ever gets up and running. But it's doubtful that it will. Interoperability is about more than just having radios that can talk to each other. It's also about having people, trained communicators, who can talk to each other in a language that everyone can understand clearly the first time around. We have so many jurisdictions with so many different protocols and even different 10 codes that just putting everything together on the same frequency will not solve our interoperability problems during large-scale communications. The Incident Command System, ICS, and the National Incident Management System, NIMS, were developed to try to combat this non-technical obstacle to interoperability, but their success has been marginal at best, and we are starting to hear rumblings that proposed new NIMS guidelines water down already thin requirements for training and cooperation. We haven't seen the specifics yet, but our sense is that here in the United States at least, amateur radio emergency communications combining personal equipment, frequency agility, and trained operators will continue to be a vitally important part of emergency and disaster response for a long time to come. It's still the only thing proven to work when all else fails. Let's have a little conversation now about the Charlotte Hamfest. That was my reason for being at the airport when news of the Japanese earthquake broke. With its new location in Concord, there's no longer any chance of sharing space with the woodworking show. This year, though, we shared the facility with the North Carolina State High School Wrestling Championships. A little bit of confusion, but also a great opportunity for the Hamfest volunteer posted outside the wrestling entrance to not only direct people looking for the Hamfest to the right place, but also to explain to many high schoolers and their families what a Hamfest and a ham radio are all about. As with Orlando in February, attendance at Charlotte seemed to be up over last year, and it was quite crowded into the afternoon on Saturday. We even managed to do a little bit of business on Sunday. As always, the Carolina DX Association dinner was a highlight of the trip. And the highlight of the dinner for me was two ex-Brooklynites each trying to outdo the other on who was more of a real Brooklynite. And kind of like being a real ham. It ended in a draw, each reluctantly admitting that the other might indeed actually have come from that storied borough of New York City. Next Hamfest for me is Dayton. I hope to see many of you there. To close on a serious note, we extend our condolences to our industry colleagues, friends, and fellow hams who lost loved ones in the quake and tsunami, and our hopes and prayers are with all of those who are struggling to recover. May the spirit of Ham Radio Fellowship help you through these difficult times. 73 W2VU, Rich Mawson. I have a few announcements now for the month of May. USS Yorktown back on the air. From May 14, 1200 Zulu to May 15, 0400 Zulu, the call sign NWKJ. We'll be back on the air for the first time in 41 years. Yorktown will be activated by the South Carolina Navy Marine Corps MARS members as well as operators from Region 4 for the annual military crossband test. They will be on various frequencies, lower sideband and upper sideband. Let's check out now a few of the hamfests for May 16th. Fleet at MIT. Cambridge, Massachusetts. Albany and Main Street, Cambridge, Massachusetts, sponsored by the Harvard Wireless Club. Their call is W1AF, the MIT Electronics Research Society, the MIT UHF Repeater Association, and the MIT Radio Society. May 20th through 22nd, Dayton Hamvention, Dayton, Ohio, the Hara Arena. May 20th, Dayton Hamvention DX Dinner, sponsored by the Southwest Ohio DX Association in conjunction with the Dayton Hamvention. The dinner will be held on Friday, May 20, at the Dayton Marriott, 1414 South Patterson Boulevard. In Dayton, Ohio, of course, there's a lot of commentary in the magazine and other publications about the Dayton Hamvention, which is considered, without a doubt, the biggest and most attended hamvention or hamfest in the world. May 29th, Memorial Day Hamfest, Howard County Fairgrounds, Route 144 West, Friendship, Maryland. There isn't much more detail about that one on May 29th, the Memorial Day Hamfest for Howard County Fairgrounds, but if you're interested, you could email for more information to the following. It's a call sign, WA3MNN@Verizon.net. That's sort of a short listing for the different events in the following month or two. There aren't any even listed for June yet, so you'll have to work with those that I've just given you. If you're one of those amateurs who loves to work RTTY, radio teletype, we have the results of the 2010 contest, which begins on page 114 and concludes on page 24, I believe. So there's a lot of stuff in between that, advertisements and all. But if you're really into it, if you can't read it for yourself, of course, I suggest that you have someone work through that with you. Let's move now to the public service division of the magazine by Richard Fisher, KI6SN. It's titled Dayton's Amateur of the Year, MCOM. Recognizing that a lack of equipment and ability were insurmountable barriers at the time, Shirley Roberts let her license elapse many years ago, dropping out of amateur radio. However, in 1986, the encouragement of friends brought her back. Now, 25 years later, N8LX finds herself the 2011 Dayton Hamvention Amateur of the Year, MCOM, not surprisingly, played a role in her selection. A quotation, "This prestigious award goes to an amateur who has demonstrated significant contribution to amateur radio as well as related public service," close quote. The Hamvention announcement noted, continuing, "Shirley exemplified all of the deepest aspects of this award." Like so many radio amateurs, while Roberts sees public service as an inherent responsibility, it is not an all-consuming pursuit to her. She eagerly serves when called upon, and N8LX has a portfolio that shows it. Well, more than a decade ago, during a conversation on the Fairfield, Ohio Amateur Radio Association's 145.19 FM repeater, Roberts noticed the fellow on the other end was having some sort of problem. "He was a trucker, and he told me he had a toothache and hadn't done anything about it. He was starting to get incoherent and had pulled off the road." But what road? In order to get him help, Roberts of Dayton knew she'd need to determine his location. The 145.19 machine was a wide area repeater, so he could be virtually anywhere in the Dayton, Fairfield, Cincinnati area. "I had an outside antenna," Roberts recalled, "and could hear him on the repeater's input. From that and from the vague description of the area he gave me, it meant he wasn't too far away from me." She called a ham acquaintance who was good at direction finding, DFing. "By the time we were done talking, he decided to go out and try to find this trucker," Roberts reported. "He got several other DFers involved. By the time the ailing driver was found, he was losing his faculties," Roberts said. "He'd driven into some bushes along an exit off a main highway, so it was fortunate the DFers were able to find him. The trucker ended up in a hospital. He wasn't there very long," Roberts said. "However, everyone seemed to think her actions and those of the DFers could well have saved his life. I'm glad I started talking on the repeater with him when I did," she said. According to her biography, Roberts, who is sight-impaired, served as a sky-worn liaison as well, handling preliminary check-ins while net control operators were en route to a communications command center. On one occasion, she agreed to be the net control during a flood, a circumstance that she assumed would be brief, her bio noted. "The event resulted in many hours over a three-day period. Because this was her first time conducting a net, it was a hands-on learning experience." Roberts was so successful in handling the flood emergency, she was asked to be an ARIS net control. For her net control activities, she used a Braille PDA, personal digital assistant, to keep track of call signs and other net information. She is an active member of the American Council of the Blind Radio Amateurs and a member of QCWA, Quarter Century Wireless Association. Additionally, she holds a life memberships in the American Radio Relay League and Handy Hams. Roberts graduated from Meadowdale High School in Dayton, going on to earn a Bachelor of Arts degree in social work from Wright State University. She is president of the ACB Diabetics in Action, a national organization providing support and information for blind, visually impaired people with diabetes. Roberts is on the board of directors of the American Council of the Blind of Ohio as well. N8XL will receive the Amateur of the Year Award at the 2011 Dayton Hamvention, which runs from May 20th through the 22nd at the Hara Arena. Here's another interesting public service piece in this article. Georgia hams are more and more of a resource. Under the headline, Hams Play Big Part in Tracking Storms, radio amateurs in Hall County, Georgia, got accolades from the region's fire chief for playing a key role in many places in Georgia when events such as snowstorms occur. I suppose, folks, as a side comment, also as these terrible hurricanes that now plaguing the southern part of the country. Continuing, Hall County relies on a network of more than 30 amateur radio operators in times like these, according to the chief, David Kimbrell, who also serves as the county's Emergency Management Agency Director. And another short commentary about hams in Christchurch, New Zealand. Hams support Christchurch MCOM effort after quake. Radio amateurs providing disaster communications in Christchurch, New Zealand, were extensively supporting the urban rescue operation following the devastating earthquake that struck February 22nd, according to Stuart Smart, call ZL4FZ of the region's amateur radio emergency communications system. There were about 250 staff in the field, and all of that communication was coming back through AREC, Smart reported. In early March, rescue efforts were shifted to a recovery phase, according to a report from Jim Linton, VK3PC, chairman of the International Amateur Radio Union Region 3 Disaster Committee. Christchurch Mayor Bob Chapman announced the change with a death toll at 161 and 200 people missing, the report said. Under arrangements with New Zealand Civil Defense and Emergency Management, AREC members are trained in disaster response, Linton said. Operations have been confined to VHF frequencies and avoided use of HF high-frequency channels identified for that purpose. Some 67% of affected people have had water supplies restored, and even fewer are reconnected to the sewer, while 27,000 are without power, Linton reported in early March. The Minister of Civil Defense declared a state of national emergency, which had been extended until midnight, March the 7th. I've just come across an interesting article titled Kit Building. The author here is Joe Eisenberg, K0NEB. It's titled Several New Kits to Debut at Dayton. With the Dayton Hamvention fast approaching, I thought it would be good to look at a kit that has been seen there many times. This kit is the Basic 7, a 40-meter CW transceiver made by Marconi of Japan. It features a rather heavy-duty case, a VFO, and a single-sided board. All the knobs, connectors, and case parts are included. Connections to the board are made by terminal posts, something I have not seen in a long time. This makes it easy to remove connections when servicing the board. The instructions can be downloaded as PDF files and are available in English and Japanese. The directions are written in English, and they suggest printing sheets that have the parts outlined on them for inventory purposes. These part identification sheets are designed for the builder to tape each part to its outlined spot on the paper. It is a great idea for sorting the parts and checking for missing parts, but also time-consuming if the parts are taped to the sheets as suggested. I simply laid the parts onto the sheets to inventory them and then placed them into my usual tackle box sorting bins. Taping the parts to the sheets does keep them from being lost, but also makes for a very time-consuming building process and can easily tear the paper when they are removed. Instead of part-by-part assembly instructions, the company simply shows you a photo of a completed stage plus the schematic for that stage to identify which parts are placed where on the board. Interesting, huh? The builder builds it a stage at a time, completing tests after each stage. A real good idea. An interesting feature of this kit is that it includes the parts to make an RF probe and the dummy load to assist in checking out the kit after assembly. The instructions also have the builder go through a number of tests as each stage of the radio is added. From the very beginning, when you verify the power supply is connected correctly to the keying circuits and the others as they follow. Be sure to use the dummy load as directed to protect the output transistor during testing. Once all the parts are assembled, the controls already have the leads cut for the parts to fit in the case. So the board mounts in the case and all of the controls and jacks fit into their mounting holes. A bit unusual is the fact that two of the controls, an attenuator, and the main power switch are located on the rear panel. The knobs in front are quite large and easy to use. But no markings are provided to calibrate to VFO, a task that can be remedied with a label maker. This kit, the Basic 7, is going to be available for display at the Dayton Hamvention in the month of May. Now here's a kit with only 26 parts. The 4-state QRP group has released its new kit for 2011. It is a 40-meter CW transceiver with a part count of only 26. It is built on a round board similar to the Tuna Tin series of kits, but smaller and sized to fit in a deviled ham can. The transceiver features a regenerative receiver and puts out 0.5 to 1 watt of RF. With just 3 toroids to wind, it makes for a great group kit building project you can get on the air within a short time. Be sure to have a dummy load handy for testing it, as well as a set of earbuds for the receive audio. You can check that out on the website if you're interested, www.4sqrp.com. If you still want to talk about kits, let's see what the new goodies are from KI60S. Doug Hendricks has quite a few new kits ready to be unveiled at Dayton this year. First, he is introducing a 30-meter version of the already popular NADC40, which is a 40-meter CW transceiver with VFO and digital display. Another introduction is a digital antenna dipper, a device to test antenna tuning without using your radio. Related to that kit is a digital antenna analyzer with digital display of SWR, impedance, and whatever. This kit will be competitive with the MFJ antenna analyzers. It promises a 2x16 character LCD display, long battery life, a custom case, and many useful functions, and is designed by Dan Taylor, called N7VE. Doug also has a kit introduced around the beginning of this year that is ideal for first-time kit builders and clubs looking for a group building project. The $18 Code Practice Oscillator kit even comes with a key you assemble yourself. The battery is also included, and the kit is available now. It assembles quickly and is a great tool to teach both kit building and Morse code. When building this as a group project, be sure to have a drill handy to make the holes needed to mount the kit properly. I would highly recommend this kit for its simplicity and the ability to begin a code class once the kits are assembled. Morse code instruction goes great when every student has their own kit and oscillator they build themselves. Another kit Hendrix will introduce at Dayton is the Weber 3-band CW transceiver kit. This kit allows the builder to choose three HF bands and offers digital display of the operating frequency, making it a great addition to any QRP shack. Look for Doug at Dayton in the North Hall, or you can check him out on the internet as well, www.qrpkits.com. Let's move along now to What's New by Joe Wood, called WV5J. He's also checking out various new things that are available. Here's a piece that says, New version of MicroLog. Software author Jerry Gentry, WA0H, tells me he has added so many new features to his popular MicroLog program that it constitutes an entirely new release of the product, which runs under Windows XP, Vista, and Windows 7, both 32 and 64-bit versions. Since its first release in March of 2004, Jerry has consistently improved his logging application and has written into his latest version numerous features such as multiple ways to search the United States Canadian call book, including by county, giving the operator the choice of date formats, a choice of which field to display in the log table on the main screen, and a choice of from over 50 modes of communication, such as Echolink, D-Star, and PSK. Purchase of this new version will also allow you the option of replacing the U.S. map on the main screen with DX spots from the OH8X Summit. The use of QCWA, 1010, and FIST numbers, and the capability of updating the built-in United States Canadian call book for up to 1 year. Jerry has also made available a new field day module if needed. If you're interested in that product, the price is listed here, but we'll let you look it up. It's www.wa0h.com. A free trial version of the application may also be downloaded from the same website. And there's some rumors from China as well. Recently in this column, we took a look at a couple of radios from China, in particular the Ouxing, which is actually spelled Ouxun. The model is KG-UVD-1P dual-pan portable and a Greccom PSR-700EZ scan SD scanner. At the time, there was a vague reference made to a dual-pan mobile also anticipated to be coming from China. Since then, we've found out that a new HT, the UVD-3, is now on the market, and that the dual-band mobile is expected to receive the designation KG-UV920R and was scheduled to be released in early 2011. Well, so far, not much has been heard or seen of this ham rig, even though you may catch a few rare photos of the unit scattered across the World Wide Web. There's also one website where you can make a reservation for the mobile rig when it does finally arrive in the United States market. Another piece of information found on the web claims that the dual bander will operate on 2 meters with power settings of 50 watts, 25 watts, and 5 watts, and a UHF ham band with 40 watts, 20 watts, and 5 watts, and will be able to receive commercial AM and FM broadcasts. It will be interesting if the information we've gleaned so far about this dual bander becomes fact upon the release of the actual radio. But you can be sure that when it does hit the U.S. market, we'll try to be among the first to let you know about it. We have a little book corner commentary. Not too many books often promoted here, but this is a good one and an interesting one, and rightfully deserving a commentary. Extra Class License Manual. The American Radio Relay League, ARRL, has just released its 9th edition of the Extra Class License Manual, which includes all of the exam questions with the answer key for use from July 1, 2008 to June 30, 2012. For all of you who have been enjoying the privileges of your ticket but have yet to upgrade, this book is your path to gaining all of the additional frequencies and operating capabilities granted by the Ultimate Amateur Radio License, the Extra Class. The book covers operating practices, rules and regulations, electrical principles, electronic circuits, radio signals and measurements, radio modes and equipment, antennas and feed lines, radio propagation, and safety. At the end of the book, you'll find the extra class license question pool, and attached to the last page, there is an ARRL exam review CD-ROM, which will enable you to review the study material and take randomly generated practice exams using questions from the actual examination question pool. So why put it off any longer? Earn the license that gives you access to the entire amateur radio frequency spectrum. It's the ARRL's Extra Class License Manual, and it's available from the American Radio Relay League website, www.arrl.org. I have a category here titled the Ham Notebook. It's offered by Wayne Yoshida, call KH6WZ. A new kind of place. A different sort of club meeting. The ham radio crashers are designing a robot that will have a variety of radio gear on it. I received an Arduino, microcontroller kit for Christmas. I wondered what to do with this thing, so I used my favorite internet search engine to find as much information as I could about the Arduino microcontroller family. I'll spell that A-R-D-U-I-N-O. U-N-O, two words. References to this interesting piece of technology and what people are doing with it are everywhere. Plus, a fellow CQ columnist on Rotolo, call N2IRZ, introduced us to the Arduino, in the February 2011 issue of CQ Magazine. That was on page 79, if you have back issues. As I bookmarked certain web pages for further study, I came across a blog site for a hardware hacker group in the Los Angeles, California area called Crash Space. They even have a section for ham radio. It's titled Radio Mondays. I think the home page provides a great short description of what kind of place Crash Space is. Quoting, "We are a collection of hackers, programmers, builders, makers, artists, and people who generally like to break things and see what new things we can build with the pieces." Close quotation. The ham radio crashers are designing a robot that will have a variety of radio gear on it. They are also discussing radar systems and radio location theory and will examine specific examples of small radar equipment that hackers can get and modify easily, such as the Mattel Hot Wheels registered trademark radar speed gun. Wow! Next on their schedule are experiments on XB, low-power digital radios. Radio Mondays are held every Monday at 8 p.m. and are open to walk-in visitors. Justin Corwin from the group said, "A good 10% of our members have been people who just heard about one of our public events and came out looking for their specific interest." Radio Mondays, the Mega Take Apart, and Handmade Music are probably the top three for walk-ins. I had to go there to see what kind of place this is. I decided to go on public night, when guests can stop by to see what the group is about and meet the members. Fortunately, the crash space is not too far from my office space, and it was an easy drive, even in traffic. I have been aware of places like this from reading magazines such as Make and watching the occasional public television shows that cover amateur scientific events. There's The Crucible in Oakland, California, and Make-NYC in New York City. I became fascinated by the various blog entries by the members and their projects and activities. One thing that really stood out was the very interesting and eclectic collection of people in the group, which included young men and women. The second thing I noticed is the very interesting concept of the crash space itself. It is a collection of hardware hackers, artists, and technologists with interests in computer hardware and software, rocketry and aerodynamics, machining and metalworking, and other things. They have meetings every night and have group activities such as building projects, including a capacitance meter kit. During my visit on public night, Therian Throbridge demonstrated a large monome he constructed. A monome is an adaptive computer interface, but is a little difficult to explain. Check the Monome community website for more information. The buttons light up and change functions according to custom programming. Theron used the laser cutter to build a custom case for each module and put together several modules to form one unit. The group exists solely on donations from local companies and the members. It has a pretty impressive machine shop, which includes a CNC mill with an interesting modification. A modified computer game joystick can be used to control the X and Y movements of the cutter head. The computer is wireless, of course, so the operator can move around the machine as the material is being worked. Another interesting machine in their shop is a small laser cutting marking machine and a 3D printer. The 3D printer is an interesting piece of equipment. It interfaces with a computer, and just about any three-dimensional drawing can be turned into a plastic object. I noticed a laptop computer mounted on one of the walls. More than a strange wall decoration, the computer is called the Space Presence Monitor. Members check in on the computer, then push the big button. And the button is backlit with LEDs, and different colors indicate which people are in the space. The main purpose of this monitor is to let others remotely check to see if anyone is home. They can go to a web page, poll the presence monitor, and see who is there so they can get into the building. The author continues by posing the question, can ham radio clubs adapt and evolve? After my visit, I thought about the new people I had met and the exciting projects they were working on. I thought about the enthusiasm of the group and was impressed with the way everyone interacted with each other, imparting knowledge to others and contributing to the space. There is definitely a buzz going on at Crass Space. It has a pull or an attraction to it, very much like the way a moth is drawn toward a light at night. I compared what I saw and experienced at Crash Space to every ham radio club I have ever visited or joined. The differences are amazing. The two groups are almost complete opposites. I feel that if our typical ham radio clubs fail to consider adapting a different concept, memberships may continue to decline. I am not saying that all ham radio clubs are boring, are full of old and old-fashioned people, or do not have exciting projects going on. But I am saying that our, quote, radio-only, close quote, clubs may need to consider including other related activities as part of their clubs so that younger and non-radio technology people may be encouraged to take an interest in ham radio. For example, Crash Space has How to Solder classes and group-built projects. It has a show-and-tell, where everyone takes a turn to talk about his or her current project. Any radio club could hold an event like this, but this is only a beginning. Another example can be more advanced classes, such as how to use a network analyzer or transistor curve tracer. Folks, the author concludes by commenting, imagine a club like this in your neighborhood. Where else can one learn how to barbecue smoke a rack of spare ribs properly, program an Arduino, you know, to do something useful or entertaining, meet other people with varying yet common interests, have access to CNC machines, learn from real rocket scientists, learn how to make clothing out of fiber optic fabrics, and, oh yes, talk about ham radio. The article is signed 73 Wayne, KH6, WZ. Here's another category that I haven't read about, I don't believe. Mobiling by Jeff Reinhardt, AA6JR. May is Mobile Month. Ham Radio mobile operations are alive and well, from the robust Hilltopper trucks to the most discreet stealth installation and everything in between. Ham gear and a vehicle go together like warm cookies and a glass of cold milk. Making me hungry here. Don't think, either, that mobile operations pertain just to wheeled vehicles. Marine mobile operations are not only popular, but have added benefits in the form of operator safety and a great mobile platform, usually with no nearby obstacles, not to mention a great ground plane. Also, with a gracious private pilot's permission, I've had the thrill of operating aeronautical mobile, actually speaking with unsuspecting members of the family who I spotted driving along while I was floating above. I have also made contact while riding the rails. Other non-conventional platforms include a friend who chats while bicycle mobile, another who operates motorcycle mobile, but I have yet to bag a coveted contact with a unicycle or a skateboarder. After all, one has to have goals. There's another form of mobile operations I find interesting, and that is from unmanned conveyances, such as ATV transmissions from model aircraft, electric trains, and remote-controlled cars. Those pictures are now easier than ever to enjoy, as mini-cams and transmitters keep getting smaller and smaller. The first time I saw a model train camera, I was blown away at the model scenery coming alive as the camera-equipped locomotive traveled along its route. I know those transmissions are technically remote, but hey, if it moves, I consider it mobile. Amateur radio is an amazing pursuit when you consider the many permutations and opportunities it offers. The month of May is also Dayton Month, which is a happy coincidence. If you can make it to the annual festivities at the Dayton Hamvention, mobiling there, of course, you will be treated to the latest and greatest in terms of rigs, antennas, and accessories that will add to your operating enjoyment. However, if you cannot make the trip, you can still enjoy some of the benefits. An increasing number of Dayton forums and activities are now available on the web. So be sure to check out that source. Also, many of the manufacturers and dealers celebrate the time of the Hamvention by running Dayton specials with reduced prices at their stores nationwide, not just for the fortunate few, thousands, at the Hera Arena. If you're considering the purchase, now would be the best time to ask your favorite vendor if there are any special coupons or promotions you should know about. By checking the ads and articles in these publications, you'll probably see that there are several new products of interest to the mobile operator. Rigs are getting smaller, but the list of standard features continues to grow. Every major manufacturer adds rigs that have detachable control panels and displays, offering excellent flexibility in mounting your gear to today's vehicles. As mentioned in previous columns, several vehicles now place the car's 12-volt battery in the trunk, making direct access to that power source easier and less complex than running cables through the firewall, remember those days, into the engine compartment. Combine that with a remote head radio and a truck mount antenna, and you have a nice compact package with minimal wiring. Last time around, I mentioned that we'd try to get updates from the car manufacturers on their policies for mounting mobile radios in their respective vehicles. I must admit I fell a bit behind on my communications with them, but I have since addressed that on my end. Hopefully, we'll get replies from all of the, or most of the major automakers, but my early efforts have not been promising. It would seem the RF engineers are not well known to the folks in the PR section. Nevertheless, we'll press for answers because mobile radios are important to many fleet buyers. That's police, taxis, and fire vehicle purchasers. So it's reasonable to think that supporting mobile two-way radio operation is not unheard of to companies that court these large volume buyers. One example includes a rather well-known manufacturer at a time when it seems that nearly every police agency in the country uses one of its makes as a radio platform. So far, it has taken its media relations group 2.5 months to process my request for information. You can see, folks, he's not telling you who that famous brand is. I don't think I blame him there. And after having received an acknowledgement, they'd get on the request ASAP. They haven't yet, I guess. Info from the manufacturer is important in that more and more RF devices are going into cars, including RDIF keys that aren't keys in the traditional sense. Sensors for those keys are located in several positions around the vehicle. RFID, satellite radio, and broadcast radio antennas are being embedded in spoilers, outside rearview mirrors, and in front, rear, and now side windows. And that's just the beginning. In order to avoid a costly mistake that either voids the warranty or damages the vehicle, mobile radio installers and operators need to be aware of sensitive areas and if there are any transmit power limitations or optimal antenna locations. There are many new and exciting vehicles on the road and more new models coming soon. In the meantime, if you intend to install a mobile transceiver in a new car, be sure to check with your dealer to determine if there are cautions, restrictions, or guidelines before you buy. Most dealers have a hotline to their respective manufacturers for technical questions. Perhaps a shortcut would be to ask if they have a tech advisory sheet on how to install a mobile radio in a fleet vehicle. Hopefully, you haven't experienced a strange reaction one of my previous cars had. Each time I transmitted on 40 meters, the windshield wipers would cycle one time. I eventually cured the problem. I sold the car. Enjoy these motor trips, especially the ones to and from Dayton, and those QSOs that make your travel even more fun. 73 Jeff, AA6JR. Ladies and gentlemen, this brings me to the conclusion of the digest format reading of CQ Magazine for May 2011 here on the Courage Handy Ham System. CQ is a publication of CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 New Bridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at Area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. The website, www.handyham.org. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call is N1BLF. November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. QTH, location Dartmouth, Massachusetts. Have a great summer just beginning. 73.